The late Nobel Prize laureate, the Jew Elie Wiesel, wrote a book called Memoirs. He, as a young boy and as a young man, spent time in German concentration camps in the Second World War, in Auschwitz and Birkenwald, saw horrors beyond imagining. His own father, in a weakened state, died beside him as they lay in a snow-covered open train car on their way between camps. Wiesel writes, "I never renounced my faith in God. I have risen against his justice, protested his silence, and sometimes his absence. But my faith rises within faith, my anger within faith, and not outside it. If that hurts, so be it. Sometimes we must accept the pain of faith so as not to lose it." 2 weeks ago, I married a member of this congregation, a member of the Canadian military. He married his very sweet partner, and the two of them obviously had profound affection for each other, and they had spent time being intentional, because he is a member of the military intelligence unit of the Canadian Armed Forces, and the whole congregation seemed to be from the military intelligence unit of the Canadian Armed Forces. And so he wrote a wonderful liturgy following the United Church of Canada's liturgical structure. Now, I haven't used the United Church of Canada's liturgical structure at a wedding for about 20 years, because people come to the church and they say, "Okay, we want a shave and a haircut, two bits. Nothing too long, nothing too elaborate. Just get us married." And so I do. But they had spent time writing a 15-page liturgy, which was excellently beautiful. And then they said to me, "We'd like an address from our minister." Ooh, an address to the intelligence community of the Canadian military, many of whom had served in Afghanistan. So you just can't wind up and crank and say, "Well, we hope you have a really nice time and that your relatives are good to you and that you get that house in the suburbs you're shooting for." It has to be a little better than that. And so I spent some time on it, and I told them a Fraser Highlander story, since I'm a member of the 78 Fraser Highlanders. I told them about one of our very distinguished members, a man for whom I have great affection, a man in his early 90s. He himself had been in the Royal Air Arm of the Royal Navy in the Second World War, flying missions into Europe. Upon return to Canada, he went to two Canadian universities. He organized naval business in the National Center in Ottawa, and then went into Canadian business and succeeded in a very strong way. And when I became a member of the Fraser Highlanders, he took me under his wing and said, "I'm going to drill you with sword, spontoon, and foot drill until you can become a member of the Honorable Guard." He worked very hard. That was harder for him than going to war in World War II, watching me try to go through my moves. And I can tell you that I've passed the written part of the test, so I'm almost there. I just have to do the foot drill, the sword drill, and the spontoon drill, but I'm working on it. He said to me, "Now that you're a 78 Fraser Highlanders, we have your back. You are ours. You belong to us. Nothing you do in your life will put you out of the fellowship of our group." That's a wonderful feeling to have. He told me about his wife. They had been high school sweethearts, and they had married and had a wonderful life with their family. And then 2 or 3 years ago, she developed terminal cancer and passed away. He was heartbroken. But about a year after her death, he decided to do the final funeral ritual, which they had planned together. He took her ashes and went to the far north of Ontario, to Quetico Provincial Park, 90 years old, and rented a canoe and paddled it by himself across two lakes and a portage to a little bay which they had called Loon Bay, up against a rock face, and there in the quiet of an afternoon he laid her ashes into the water. And he said, "When I die one day, my children will take the ashes in the canoes across the two lakes and the portage, and in the quiet of Loon Bay they will lay my ashes beside those of my beloved." That's a wonderful story. And I felt that love and marriage were somehow visible in that as I spoke to the gathered crowd. And I had a text come to mind which addressed it, and this was the text from 2 Isaiah. "Now says the Lord, the one who created you and formed you, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. When you pass through the water, I will be with you. When you go through the rivers, they shall not overcome you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you, because you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you. So I said to them, mutual love is the impetus to sign up for the thing in the first place, and married love is the intentional and disciplined rise through the ranks over the years. Do not fear, for I've redeemed you, because you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you. That's a firm foundation on which to live, isn't it? Wouldn't you love to hear that every day of your life, to get up in the morning and feel that that warm coal has a place inside your soul? Most of the time, we have other realities pressing in on that, and they express themselves in the F words, the words we avoid if we can in polite company, the words that offend us when we hear them and demean in our minds those who speak them, words like folly and fault and force and falsehood and failure and forsakenness. They haunt us and chase us like a motorcycle gang on a dark street. They demean the speaker and the hearer. There are critical essential F words, though, that need to be heard, because it will change our perception of things and help us in our life. And the first of the F words that came to mind is the word fear. We need to hear the word fear. I believe we are much more fearful about everything than we let ourselves acknowledge. Our newly turned 8-year-old grandson, Jack, was at the cottage up north with his family, and they were watching a family of ducks come along, the mother and 8 little ducklings swimming beautifully in the calm water, and suddenly up from the bottom of the water, like Jaws, came a snapping turtle and snapped one of the little ones, and it disappeared in a moment. And Jack's eyes got really big, and he said to his mother, I will never go into that lake again. I will never go. And then a few weeks ago, he saw the actual trailer of Jaws. What a bad idea. He said, does every lake have a shark in it? No, no, no. Do they eat you as soon as you go near the water? No, no, no. And there are my other children piling it on instead of taking it off. Oh, Jack, you're going to have to wear your armor if you go. So we said, stop that. This child is having a fit about what's under the water. Fear had gripped this little boy at the age of 8, and by the look of it, it went deep. We fear much more than we realize. We fear for our personal safety. Dark streets and grim statistics and the rule of a gun, be in the wrong place at the wrong time, be caught in the crossfire, and there you go. We fear for our health and our well-being. A sudden attack of something could arise, or a slow invasion of an illness could come, or some catastrophic turn in the road could occur. A woman came into the church the other day, and she was standing out in the hall, and she was looking through the brochures, and I said, may I help you? And she said, I'm looking for the brochure where it says to come to this church, you don't have to believe in God. I said, well, I don't think that's exactly in one of our brochures, but I'll help you look. I said, what's it for? She said, my son, who's 51, was in a terrible motorcycle accident, and he's in the hospital. And then they did a medical treatment on him, which seemed to make it worse. And now he can't speak and he can't breathe and he's in intensive care. And I wanted to say to him, there is a place for you beyond your fear. And you don't even have to believe 6 things to get in the door. And we talked for a while. And I prayed for her and for her son. And she said, would you come and see him one day? I said, yes, I will. And I gave her my numbers. And we wait. Fear. The sudden turning of the road. We fear global events and politics too. Are we not all saying, stop taunting the rocket man? Stop taunting him. Take your finger off the button, for God's sakes. Someone has written, aggression is the stuff of arrogant entitlement. It is the farthest from the best of our human nature. We know that. We know the potential cost of going down this road. We have a fear of life loss and of a sense of self and a place in the tribe and personal life relationships. We get up every morning with that fear at our backs. What if I fail? What if somebody finds out about me? What if she leaves me? What if he dies? What if I'm fired from my work and my life unravels? What if I can't keep up the pace of what others expect from me? There is the fear of disability and decline and death and the unknown. We are mortal, and the dust beneath our feet tells us that every moment of every day. Look down, and you see part of your mortal destiny. We feel like the Israelites who said to Moses and Aaron, "Why in the world did you bring us out here into this wilderness to die? We should have stayed within the security of Egypt." But the thing is, the security of Egypt is not secure. Egypt is an inherited world, the one into which we are born, without much thought, and it's filled with convenience and always filled with compromise. We are compromising ourselves in every moment. It is often an oppressive world in which we can be used and misused and undervalued. We become a statistic or a consumer or whatever anyone else wants us to be. And it's also a fleeting world because every empire in the world will eventually collapse. So the F-word fear has frozen the scene. It limits our joy and it stalks our dreams. We are more afraid than we realize. I think St. Paul was often afraid. We read of him through the dust of centuries, and we think, well, he's been dead for 2,000 years. It doesn't really, really matter what he thought or really matter who he was. Occasionally, we might lick our thumbs and flip through a text, but it doesn't really, really matter. But if you read a little bit of Paul's story in his own letters, you hear about his life. This man was beaten on a number of occasions and harassed everywhere and spurned and scorned and imprisoned and chained to a soldier for 2 years and then executed by the very empire of which he was a citizen. Still, he pressed on. He said, "It is vital for me to tell the life-saving story which has transformed my life. It's vital to tell the life-saving story, because everybody needs to hear what the life-saving stories are in the midst of a life-draining world." I listened to The Current the other morning on CBC Radio. Carol Off, one of the announcers on As It Happens and other CBC Radio programs, was speaking of a personal incident when she was a journalist in Afghanistan. There was a man there who had been a translator and had been working for the Allies there, and then he had lost his cover and was being dropped by them. And she got involved just to hear his story, and as a journalist listening to the story and so on, and she realized the quality of the life he had lived and the risk he had taken on behalf of the Allied movement and the danger in which his family found itself. And it took her 9 years of personal lobbying from her position of notoriety and also of her passion, 9 years for the Canadian government to turn in their direction and consider giving them refugee status in this country. 9 years. She said, "I crossed a line somewhere between journalistic distance and the passion of a real life. And when I met them at the airport after 9 years, his hair had turned from brown to gray, and his children had grown up. My eyes filled with tears, and I threw my arms around them and said, 'I love you. I love you.'" There it is. It's vital to tell the life-saving stories that are making you whole. We need to hear them. And so the F word here is fortitude. What level of guts do we have to say what we have sensed to be right? Are we living anywhere near the range of our potential? Where is our fortitude? Yesterday, when I arrived at the church early for the 78th Fraser Highlander Celebration of Honors, the first thing that greeted me was a drug-laden man in his 40s who'd ridden his bicycle as far as the side steps, fallen over on it, was lying sprawled across his bicycle, out cold and unable to be revived. We stood around him for a few moments, then we called an ambulance, and the ambulance came and shook him and stood him on his feet and took his bicycle and said, "Would you like to go to the hospital?" And he said he wouldn't. And the last time I saw him, he was staggering off through the park with his bicycle into whatever world awaited him. That's the start of the day, the start of the day. One of our staff members who's responsible for the community service aspect of our church said to me, "We must reclaim the park." Well, we know we must reclaim the park. For 40, 50 years, we have realized that the influence of this congregation and its ministry goes to the extended edges of the curb right around the block, not just to the doors of the church. We know that. And we've made efforts to do it over and over, and they've risen and succeeded, and they've fallen back, and then we regroup and do it again. And here is a new voice on the staff saying, "We must reclaim the park, and it must be driven by the congregation." It's no sense the staff getting to do it, because once the staff leaves and goes to something else, the impetus falls away. It is the congregation's heart that must claim the park. And if you step out into the park, the simplicity of the park under those trees, you are hitting every single social issue and concern, every single wall which terrifies us you could ever see. Hunger and homelessness and drug abuse and mental illness and the walls of disgust and prejudice which we carry towards each other and which we bring to those around us, and each barrier is formidable enough to make us quit. I went out with one of our former board chairs the other day for a conversation, and he said, "Why don't we sit on a bench in the park?" And I said, "The park? Yes, we'll go and sit in the park. I don't want to go out to the park. Come and sit in my office. I have the door shut and the air conditioning is on." "No," he said, "the park. We'll go to the park." I sat in the park for the most uncomfortable 90 minutes. I'd seen people yelling and shrieking and wandering around, and I didn't know any of them. I said, "You know, I don't talk to any of these people at all." He said, "Well, why don't you start?" I had no answer for that. Let me out of here. Let me go back. And I thought about it all night, and I thought about it the next day, and it was a watershed moment for me. If we're going to reclaim the park in some way, it's necessary to discover our fortitude. Now, Paul felt he had a choice to make every day of his life. Is it better for me to step up for your sake, or to step back and be with Christ? It's the same choice. Do we step up and pay the price, the stripes and the lashing and the scorn and the risk? Or do we sit and sing our songs and enjoy our simple little groups and be ourselves, knowing that all that is out there, but since we are faithful to the Lord in our own minds, that's somehow good enough? Do I speak and write and wade in and care and draw suspicion from those who fear me and possible abuse for those around me? It's a tough question. But it's essential to know what is the level of our fortitude as human beings in this society. It's tough. Do we personally and faithfully as a community underestimate our fortitude? Is our goal through life secretly to have an easy life of it? Freedom 55, it's good to be alive. Is that the extent of the spirit that's in us, I ask? We live in an entrenched world, a tense standoff culture. Class distinction, gender superiority, sexual exploitation and expression, tribal violence, a profound resistance to somebody else's truth, corruption beneath the surface, name them all. Nobody wants to hear about that, but we're being influenced by that every single day underneath our peace. Life in Egypt was made up of gain at the cost of self-image, and comforts at the cost of surrender, and backyard bliss at the cost of the taste of a deep love of God. One day for sure, it's not going to be enough, and we will cry out to something more profound. We will cry out as a culture and a nation and a world, because we know we need something more. Now, the other F word, if that isn't enough, the other F word we must consider is fortune. What is the real reward of life? What is the fortune in life? To come home, to reflect on yourself and your day, to smile and whisper, is that enough? How do we do that? Now, Jesus' parable about the workers in the vineyard, and I hate that parable, by the way, hits us right in the pit of our stomach. Surely this cannot be an example of enough, we say. It seems unfair and unbalanced and broken. It seems from another age. It didn't work then. It doesn't work now, but there it is. We see ourselves as the keeners, the hard workers. We're in the field early. We're task-oriented. We're part of the leadership team. We're familiar with the routine and the tools. We know how to please the overlords. We're prepared to jump through hoops for the money. And then come along the layabouts, the laggards, the hopeless, the useless, the ones we step over and pass by. Why are they here, we see? They're so late, they're so loose in their life, they're so inconvenient, they're only going to get in the way, and at the end of the day, they are paid first, and they're paid with the same generous amount as we are. And we see the amount as unfair. We were here all day long, we took the abuse of the sun and the labor of the field, and a generosity that meets us at the end of our long day meets them at the end of the short day, and it's not fair. We are more deserving. Well, what's the reward? Is there a reward in that parable, I ask? In the texts overall, the reward is said to be manna, momentary nourishment at the right time to lift us up. Is that good enough? A moment of momentary nourishment, something we need to feed our hunger, to lift us up for the day. Is that the reward of life? And the reward is said to be engagement. We have been invited to come to the master's field and are included in the work. The experience over our day is the crucible in which the reward is found. Is that good enough? The experience of being engaged with others in the business of life. And gratitude in the remuneration. I am grateful for the privilege of being there. That is enough pay for me. Someone came in yesterday to a wedding. We had 200 people at the wedding, and they were a gregarious group, and one woman said to me, "This is a beautiful church." I said, "You have no idea how beautiful it is, and I am so profoundly grateful that I have had so many wonderful years to be here among this community. My gratitude goes beyond remuneration." Is this impractical, do you think, this being enough? Please remember that it's been found on the lips of Jesus, the Lord of life. There must be something to it. "Do not fear, for I've redeemed you. When you pass through the waters, I'll be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overcome you. And when you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you, because you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you." There's the fortune. That's the gift at the heart of life. That's the payment. Elie Wiesel wrote, "Was I later reconciled to God? Let's say that I was reconciled to some of God's interpreters, and to some of my prayers. These prayers do not always coincide with reality, and surely not with truth, but so what? It's up to us to modify reality and make the prayers come true."